Hello and welcome to TDF Talks, a fortnightly podcast from The Design Files, Australia's most popular design blog. I'm your host, Lucy Fagans, and I'm the founder and editor of The Design Files. Today's episode is the final in our four-part series brought to you by Mercedes Me. On the corner of Collins Street and King Street in Melbourne, Mercedes Me is a cafe, event space and concept store operated by Mercedes-Benz in partnership with Melbourne Coffee King's Centaur Lee. Throughout June and July, The Design Files has been hosting TDF Talks at Mercedes Me, a conversation series featuring speakers from architecture, design and fashion. This podcast is part of that series. Our conversation with Tim Ross was recorded live at Mercedes Me late last month. TDF Talks is an enhanced podcast, which means if you listen using the Overcast or Pocket Casts apps, you will see images and links in your player while you listen. Over the years, Tim Ross has transitioned from being a pretty famous TV and radio comedian to becoming an unlikely spokesperson for Australian design and architecture. His consistent focus throughout is storytelling. In recent years, Tim has been incredibly busy with his comedy show Man About the House, which he's taken all across Australia and the world. He's also written and produced a hugely popular ABC TV series called Streets of Your Town, and he's written and self-published a book, The Rumpus Room, and he's even curated a design exhibition at the Powerhouse Museum in Sydney. It's certainly pretty far removed from his days on breakfast radio. Tim has an uncanny way of getting people excited about design, even things they didn't realise they really cared about. Things like the classic Hills Hoist washing line, or the Dolphin Torch, or Sydney's brutalist Sirius building. That's why Tim is such an important ally to have when we talk about Australian architecture and design. In the following conversation, Tim shares his journey from breakfast radio host to architecture and design guy. He offers his thoughts on the factors that make a building iconic, and why he insists that even ugly buildings are often worth saving. Our conversation with Tim was recorded live and comes with a language warning.
Hello, everyone. I was just thinking, actually, we've been friends for a long time, haven't we now? Six, seven, how long?
Yeah, maybe 7 years.
7 years, but never lived in the same city together.
Do you think?
So we have a friendship that's based on distance.
We have a long-distance relationship.
Do you think we would... What if I lived in Melbourne again, would we hang out or would it... Do you think we could be friends, like proper friends, or do you think Lucy and I would survive the real world? So it's a bit, we've divided the room here.
Do you know what I think it is? It's that thing of you grew up in Melbourne and you started off here and now you moved to Sydney, you've lived in Sydney for a long time, and it's that thing of like,
I've changed.
Think you're a Sydney-sider now,
yeah,
you know?
I am.
But anyway, you've still got the Melbourne roots.
Do you know the really interesting thing about being a – Melbourne's a really interesting place because if you think about it in terms – it's a very inward-looking place. And I didn't realise until recently there's a real historic reason for that, and because Sydney's an outward-looking place because it was a city based on taking the resources from Australia and then throwing them back into the world. It was like – it's a colony city, so it's always an outward-looking city. But Melbourne is not that city. This is a city built on itself. And so if you look at why I love AFL so much is that, and it's so ridiculous, but you guys love it so much, and we all love it, is that one day you're thinking, you know what? The world's going to work out that footy is the best game in the world and everyone will play it. Never going to happen, but it's top of mind for people in Melbourne. And it sort of symbolises, you know, this inward-looking thing. And I love it just because it's the only place in the country where if someone gives you an old-fashioned landline number, you won't bother giving you an area code. And it doesn't make sense to you, but every time
Is that true?
Yeah.
Wow. So in Sydney, everyone says 02.
Because you presume. But here it's like, well, would you live anywhere else but Melbourne? Why would you need an area code? You know, like, why would you want to leave? Do you like Sydney? When are you coming back? The other one I get is, you've come all the way down from Sydney for this, but it's what makes Melbourne so great. And that's why so many interesting things happen here, is because it's a city that focuses on its own culture and its own exciting and really, truly interesting creative heartbeat. And that idea that you can love football and love the arts is what makes this city so amazing.
Yeah. Tim, we're going to get onto your passion for design and architecture in a moment, but I'd love to just start with a bit about your background. Mm. So can you tell us a little bit about your early career and just how you got started in radio and TV initially?
Yeah, I used to play in bands, or one particular band that I started. I went to La Trobe University, and I was going out with this girl who'd played in a band, and she said, "Oh, what do you do?" And I was studying drama, and she said, "What are your achievements? You're a funny guy, you know. And I was 23 or something. She said, "What do you do?" And I went, "Oh, play cricket." And is that it? And I went, she said, "You should do something." And because she was playing in a band and wasn't a musician, and there was a battle of bands coming up, I went, "Oh, might enter that." And all the guys I lived with were all musicians, and I was always very jealous of them being in bands. And so I entered in a battle of the bands, didn't tell them, and came home to the share houses living in North Melbourne and said, "Oh, we're in battle of the bands and you guys are in it." And they went, "Oh, okay." And that was it. And we went and we won the heat, and then we won the final, and then we started playing around, and I was doing comedy and music together. And then I met up with Merrick, who used to come and see my band, and we ended up doing stand-up and doing shows together. And literally it was one of those great things. And it is also one of the things that you can do in this city is you can fail a bit, and then your communities back you up. And, you know, we'd be doing – I loved it. We'd be playing gigs at the Punters Club or the Espy or the Tote, all those wonderful venues. And being in a band was great. There's camaraderie, and people sort of liked us. We weren't amazing, but, you know, people liked us. And then, you know, Mez and I started doing stand-up, and we're doing shows at the Prince Pat, the Rochester Castle, and we got a gig on Triple J, you know, you fill in and – to a regular spot, and before, you know, within time we were doing the drive show, and that's what took us to Sydney. And
yeah,
and then I went, you know, ended up doing breakfast radio and a whole bunch of other things for a few years.
And it really was that organic? You didn't really have a plan to be on radio or to be on TV?
Oh, I very much was very interested in television at that stage, television comedy, and I know radio, I was never a great student of radio. We sort of fell into it, to be honest, and then we got good at it. And I enjoyed my time as a broadcaster and did some really interesting things, but it's just one box, you know. You're like, it's very much a glorified office job in lots of ways. And so you go in every day and you meet people for 2 seconds, and I could rattle off an amazing list of people that I've met, but I couldn't tell you more than, oh, they were nice, or they were nice to me on that day. But you never get any deeper than that. And so what I like about what I do today is that you meet people and you truly meet them.
Yeah.
And you spend time with them and you get to know them, rather than, you know, someone comes into a studio and then you talk to them on air and record an interview with them that goes for 4 minutes. And then now it's much deeper and much more interesting.
Yeah. Well, I guess now you're driving your own kind of path in a way, rather than it being decided from, you know, by an employer. There's a bit of a disconnect there, though, between you as TV person, comedian, radio person, and then design and architecture. And so you've kind of reinvented yourself a little bit.
Yeah, I'm Madonna. I'm totally Madonna.
That's what I was getting at.
Yeah.
How did this happen? I'm always conscious of, like, being like, where did Tim Ross come from? Where did the architecture come from?
Well, you sort of let – you get old and you get weird, and you let your passions take over. And, you know, I always think about, you wake up one day and, like my dad used to be, and you just turn into your father, and you're that person who walks along one day and you look, see some piece of plastic in the park, and you go, "I wonder where that came from." And then that's your life mission, to go, "Where'd that piece of plastic come from? I wonder what's that off?" And then you put it in your pocket and you'll ask everyone where that piece, or you start saying weird things to kids on the street going, "Not a good day to be a possum." And then they go, "What are you talking about, you old bastard?" I don't know, but that's what old guys say. So it wasn't a hidden passion. And I suppose my thing is, I'd always collected mid-century modern furniture. That'd been my sort of major passion for good 20 plus years.
And that came from your dad, right?
Yeah. My father wasn't so much into furniture. He was into lots of other things, antiques dealer. But I think for some reason there was something about it that appealed, for all sorts of reasons. But, you know, it's interesting why we like things. It's an interesting window into the past. And it's certainly, you know, it's a big shared passion, I think, people who like mid-century furniture. And so and it was a very solitary passion for me, particularly in my time in Sydney. And, you know, I was just sort of quite a strange person who used to go to things on my own. And I remember, and I didn't know anyone really else who did in Sydney. And so I became friends with people at the furniture stores, or some of them that liked me. And then you'd read something on blog or something that someone had. And I remember someone suggesting that you could with Featherston chairs that you could, if to check the, whether or not that they were, because they're a molded plywood shell, and to make sure that they're okay, you sort of knee them in the back to make sure they're not broken. And so they were just like, oh, all right. And then I'd be in some furniture store taking speckies almost like on these Featherston chairs and like doing that on my own. And I suppose pre-Facebook group, pre-Instagram, there wasn't an easy community. Like I'd know people that I'd go to auctions with, but I wouldn't go all the time. There was a very small group of people. And then I thought, oh, I'd always been interested in architecture. And then I suppose I thought, oh, I need somewhere to put my furniture.
So better buy a house.
Better buy a modernist house that no one wanted. And that sort of, I didn't really know the terms, and I just didn't, it was just something I liked, you know. Yeah. And then you just, as time goes on, you sort of, you read more or you meet people, and then the stories that go with it. Social history is really interesting.
Yeah.
To me. And so that's as important, I think, as why things happened or the people who lived in these houses. And but the Sydney Living Museums used to have these things, and I'd go to a Bruce Rickard house, and I'd go by myself. Or first time I went to the Harry Seidler's place while he was still alive in Killara, I went by myself. I didn't know anyone who might want to come, and I was quite happy with that. But it was, and then, you know, then I might meet someone who might go to the next event or something, and I think they probably went, oh, what's that dude doing here? And I was always very nervous about it, and because it was very the early days of talking about architecture or more so design. I remember I was asked to talk at the opening of Sydney Design Week, and it would have been probably 12, 13 years ago, Powerhouse Museum in Sydney. And they said to me, can you come and talk? We know you like furniture. Can you come and talk about it? I went, okay. And I was so nervous trying to write these things, and I finally, what am I going to talk about? And I was just about to get on stage, and Ann Summers was the chairman of the board at that stage. And so this is incredibly wise and
serious
and extraordinary woman. I'm like, oh, and she was going to introduce me, and like, I was like, oh, I'm all shaky, and I'm just about to get on stage, and the publicist from the Powerhouse Museum said to me, she said, I'm just letting you know, the curators didn't want you to do this event, but I think you'll be fine. And I was like, ah, and I was terrible, but you know, I think I was really lucky. I had a few people, and probably the person that was most important to me was Karen McCartney. And Karen McCartney at that stage was the editor of Inside Out magazine. And Karen's that magazine at that stage, incredibly influential.
It was.
And so it was before you could get a wide range of information on the web. It was all there. But she, in those pages, was probably the first time I saw a lot of Melbourne modernist houses. She supported a bunch of mid-century people who were selling furniture. And, you know, like it literally was, it was like, oh, that's a place in Surry Hills. That's in the magazine. I'll go and check it out. It was hard to find that stuff online in those days. And then obviously her book was 50, 60, 70 Iconic Australian Houses. And that's how we met, was I think I sent her a message or something after I got it, because it was like someone had written that book for me. And I think you would get that all the time, is that the most interesting thing or the best thing you can do sometimes, or the thing that fulfills you the most, is, or the content that you like the most, is if someone's gone out of their way to do something that inspires you. And a lot of the time that involves someone doing a lot of work, not for not a lot of money, but to create something that lifts us all up. And the Featherston exhibition, I think, at Heidi is a great example of that. And I think those two curators with that's a gift, that exhibition. That's incredible. And for those people who create those sorts of things, because that brings everyone on board.
Yeah.
And creates a whole new world of things. But Karen's thing for me was she never judged me from what I did.
Yeah.
And so she just knew I was into it.
Yeah.
And so she was happy. She put my house and me in the magazine, and the conversations I had with people switched. So
yeah.
People used to talk to me about, oh, I saw you on Channel 9 doing such and such, and then suddenly people started talking to me about my house.
Well, I was going to ask you that, and I've asked that of some other people that we've featured in the past. When your house is a bit famous, it's kind of a turning point sometimes, and it becomes your calling card.
Yeah.
And so you do have a beautiful home, and we've shot it, and it's been featured in a few books and magazines. Was that a kind of turning point where you became the kind of design guy in a public sense? Like people started to recognize you as someone who had something to say?
And my view has been with the house, and it's a public thing in some ways, is that by exposing my house or letting it being on. I think, you know, I still remember, you know, you came around to shoot it for the first time, we went out or something, let you in the house and let yourself go when you finish type stuff, which was wonderful. But it was very much if people are trying to understand that looking after those houses is important, and it's certainly, you know, it's much easier to see that there's a lot more people on board, but sort of 12, 13 years ago, it's like, it's a wasteland when it came to.
Yeah.
It's very much, you know, it's a few people thinking about it. It wasn't mainstream. The discussion wasn't happening. So I thought, well, if I really believe in this, my house is open slather in terms of letting people in there for shows or yeah. whatever. And it's not, it's, I'm one of, I'm an owner along the way.
Yeah.
And it's not a, I don't think, it's not an iconic house in any way, but it's a way for people to understand if I like it, why I like it, why it's important, how you can live in a modernist house, why and how a 1950s house can work in a modern situation as yeah. a family home.
Yeah.
And it's, yeah, it's like, come and have a look at it, you know, and I've been very open with that. And
yeah,
that intersection's really interesting. We were talking about it a bit upstairs before, and I about the Featherston house in terms of a house becomes public property or and when domestic architecture becomes civic architecture in some way. And I, it's a really interesting intersection between we have an ownership over things and we see it on Instagram or we see it or we post on Instagram or we go to a house that we like. And the best homeowners understand that that there's a responsibility that goes with an iconic house. And we did that when we did the Roy Grounds house, the roundhouse in Toorak. Like this, here's a guy who's just living in that house, barracks for Richmond, loves the house. He understands it. His family understands it. He bought it off his sister. And I think those people are the best because yeah. you say, oh, of course you can come along and do a
yeah.
show there because he understands that that it is an important part of our history.
Yeah. It's interesting what you said before about how Karen McCartney kind of never judged the fact that you weren't an architect or didn't come from an architectural background or a design background. You came from this different world and she still kind of really respected your participation, I guess, in design and architecture. And I tend to think that that is actually part of your appeal or it's like your secret weapon is that you've come at this from somewhere completely different and you're a bit of an outsider in a way and it helps talk to a new audience about design and architecture.
And strangely enough, what I was trying to say on that first day at the Powerhouse Museum was inspired by that visit I had to Kalara and it was the only one and only time I met Harry Seidler. And he was there and he was like wearing these high-waisted pair of Guess jeans or something and they're right up to his tits. And it was just so like – and so much struck me about that experience, like Penelope Seidler being just this so beautiful and the house being amazing and Harry being like just banging on about getting angry about the councils, you know, sitting at the back of his house and with a bow tie on and these jeans up to his boobs. And he – and I realized at that time was that those, the worst advocates sometimes are the people who have a vested interest.
Yeah.
And that was what I was trying to badly say on that first day is that I think that in many ways the best advocates for design full stop is that the people who just love it because, you know, I don't need the clients. I can't lose the clients. The government can't turn their back on me. And I think it's really tricky sometimes the, I think the pressure that's put on architects to come out in support of buildings that are being destroyed or knocked over or all that sort of stuff, it's hard on them because if you come out and you say, look, the governments are a bag of whatever it is that we want to say that they are for knocking over that building, that means there's a potential that you get off, you don't get that next lot of work. So where for us, it doesn't really matter.
You don't care.
Yeah, because the other thing with the governments aren't that interconnected. They're sort of stupid. They don't really realize, and you'll never lose a commission. You maybe in Melbourne, but I think they're a bit, I think they're, everything's a little bit more connected here, but certainly in Sydney, they wouldn't even know. They're idiots. So, yeah, I think this idea that, as an outsider,
you have a different view,
take, and it's a lot of it's emotional.
Yeah.
A lot of it's sort of – it's. I certainly don't have the architectural language to talk about it, do I?
But that's so interesting, that point about architectural language, because I must say we feel that a little bit. Like, you know, on the design files we cover a lot of houses and we get a lot of info from architects. Every time we cover a house, I'm sure there's a few architects in the room and we love Australian architecture, but we often get very lofty kind of mission statements about architectural buildings and we understand that that makes sense to a certain audience, but we're trying to be accessible and for everyone to be able to appreciate a building. And you can't actually talk in Aki speak to everyone. Yeah. So I'm really interested in how you managed to cut through that and still say what needs to be said, but I guess, yeah, to kind of remove that loftiness from architecture.
Yeah, and I think sometimes it disappoints people, especially with the Man About the House show, and they come along and they'll think there'll be more. And I literally, that's for universities to do that stuff. And I mean, I think, you know, the amount of books I've got where I just look at the pictures and read a little bit, you know, they could, every fifth word could be balls and I'd never know, you know. It's like, it's just like, oh. And some are better than others, some are better than others. I think that's changing. And I think what's really interesting is that they always say, oh, you know, architects will go something like, how do you think we should just communicate? Because we just, you know, we're getting this language that people don't understand. And I say, just don't. Because the work speaks for itself.
Yeah.
That's the beautiful thing.
Just
let your buildings be pretty. That's what we want. The rest of it's important to a point. Tell us how we can afford it. Tell us how you can make that happen, or demystify
the process.
The process, rather than tell us why it's important.
Yeah,
because I always say that it's really easy and it's okay to say I like this building because it's cool. Or it does something to me. And great architecture should always affect you like anything else, like a great movie or a book or a song. It should lift you up. It should make you feel something.
Yeah.
It should elevate you. It should move you in that way, and the best of it does. And that we don't need to read the liner notes to know why we like a great song.
Yeah. That's a great quote.
Yeah. Write that one down, kids.
We're recording it.
Fucking tweet that one. That's your take home. Everyone needs a take home apart from the glasses. Put them in your handbag. No, don't do that, seriously.
On that note, I'm wondering then, you've been really...
On putting glasses in your handbag. I used to have a bar. People used to steal glasses. It was very annoying.
You've been really kind of accepted by the architecture community. So obviously if you're advocating for mid-century buildings, then that's a great thing for everyone to get behind. But you've also been really supported by the architecture industry and you speak at a lot of architecture events and... architects seem to like you. Have you had any pushback? Do you ever feel like a bit of an outsider? Do you ever feel like...
Oh, yeah, constantly.
Really?
Yeah, you like that. Always that time, sometimes I spend too much time, or like Venice when they have the architecture biennale and you've got everyone there. And, of course, you don't do what they do. And you do feel like the guy at the footy club going, oh, we're going to have a good game today, Jonesy. What's happening today? Oh, you're going to build a bill. Oh, all right, no worries. What's going on? Going to kick a few goals, Rachel Nolan? And so you just walk away, you know, and hang out with people who sell roller doors. So, because there's a few of them hanging around the architects too to try and sell roller doors.
Roller doors are important too.
Yeah. So, no, and you can't. But I think it was very important, especially with, say, Man About the House, was that the initial success of the live show was very much driven by architects coming along as a community and supporting it, particularly here in Melbourne. And that sort of drove it, and the support in terms of, oh, come and do this. Yeah, we'd love you to come into a house, or putting it on Instagram. And I obviously early on, you know, by no stretch of imagination do all of them like everything that I do, or like me, or like my TV shows, or there's lots of people who like to keep it in a close –
Closed shop.
That's what I was looking for. Or they just, you know, God, not everyone likes everyone. So, and that's fine. But the thing that I've liked is, I think, pretty much 100%, apart from a few of the really old ones who are a bit old and cranky, like I'm talking really old, almost all of them whose work I've liked them as people.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah.
And so I think that's really interesting. And so I don't know whether, because I like their work, they like me, or I don't know. There's something really nice about that. It's like, and that's pretty much, I think, universal across Australia, which I think says something about it.
I'm interested in how the idea for where Man About the House came from. Like, did that just come to you in a random way? Like, that was, I guess, was that the first time that you'd taken your passion for architecture and made it part of, I guess, your job?
Yeah. Well, I didn't have it. I think when I did, I have a job, might or not have had a job, or I'd been thinking about it, and I'm just a bit of a drama nerd, and I'd always liked the idea of performing in interesting places. And so much of what I'd done had sort of, I think I'd lost some sort of sense of it really liking performing, become about ticket sales and about how many people we can have in the room. And you know, with Mez, when we used to do those things, we played big venues. It was buzz, but not all of it was great. I just wanted to go back to where I wanted to go back to where I started. I wanted to go back to do it yourself. I wanted to go back to, I suppose, an idea of when I was pretty happy, and that was when I was creating things here, and that was make a zine, do the – it was – I don't know, it was a midlife crisis, but I wanted to go back to 1996, but in a new adult way. It was like I remember I did a show once, Agony Uncles, and they always like – I came up with this line for it where they talked about your 30s, and I said you relive your 20s in your 30s, but you do it with more money and a better wardrobe. And so – that's changed so much, but I think I wanted to go back and capture something that I'd forgotten that I loved, or just to reignite my passions. And so I'd had this idea to do a show at the Roseside House, which is a house that I loved, and I'd spent a lot of time there. I never thought we'd do the show inside. I thought we'd be able to do it outside, and they said yes. And it was the first shows we did were terrible. There was no doubt about it. But we just sort of pursued it, and it wasn't until Tony Lee at the Boyd Foundation. You know, I just sort of sent him an email and rang him up and said, like, I've got this idea. We've just done it here. I'd like to do it there. And he was very supportive as well. And we found our feet there. I suppose that house, I'm very attached to that house. And Kit and I always talk about it being our spiritual home for this show, because we learned where to do it well. And the show and everyone, we've leaned pretty heavily on people. The show, the house being the star to get people in the door. And I had to create a new audience. That was the toughest thing. Like, no one who used to come and see my old shows pretty much comes to see what I do. So that was tricky as well. And then I sort of threw out a whole bunch of material and then found the confidence to make sure that it was better. And within time, we got better and better at it. But yeah, Tony was great and let us stay in the house and just go mad, you know. And I always love this thing, and I love this story because he told me when the first time we were there, we'd moved that classic cork table that's there for the second series or something. Actually, no, we're doing the first series in the courtyard, and then we got in trouble from the neighbours. And so, but I'd talk about the court table, and he told me some story, and he said, all these famous people had been around that table. And I sort of started recounting the story for the whole season. I'd go, oh, it was amazing, that table over there. You know, Robin Boyd would have all these people, these dinner parties. You think about the history here in the 1950s and 60s. And, you know, you'd have Robin Boyd would be there, and then you'd have Harold Holt, the former Prime Minister, and Barry Humphries would be there. And then you'd have Ron Barassi, the footballer, there, and they'd all be around that table, and we're looking at it now, and everyone would be going, oh, that's amazing. And then it wasn't until the end of the series that Tony Lee said to me, Tim, I just want to ask you something, tell you something. Just letting you know that Robin and Barry Humphries didn't know each other. He wrote something for him, but he never came to the house. Harold Holt came to the house once, and Ron Barassi most certainly never came to the house. But that house is extraordinary, and it's this sort of I love the wonkiness of you open up a cupboard and there's like the archive falls out and it is untouched, and it's such an important part of Melbourne, I think. So lucky to have it.
Yeah. Yeah, I sometimes wonder about how true every story is that you say.
That one's true.
Okay.
Dad, you don't think it's true?
What about that one? I came to the house, that story about Michelle and that rapper. What is that story?
The Lupe Fiasco.
Lupe Fiasco.
I'm not telling you now because it's copyright.
I always think it might be a lie.
That's 100% true.
Okay.
For those of you who haven't come to my show, I'll tell you after the show, or you can come and it'll be on a live recording or something. But, yeah, Lupe Fiasco came to my house. Very funny story, huh? Stop it, Lucy. You're a card.
It must feel really good to drive your own creative projects after so many years in commercial radio. I mean, breakfast radio in itself must be really demanding. So will we ever see you return to any of that more commercial stuff, or is this you now? Do you feel like...
Yeah, if it all goes badly, yeah. when someone says...
If we see you on a poster.
The bank manager says, yeah, no more exhibitions. No, I wouldn't think so. But I think the stuff I love is the stuff that no one really understands, and then you hope that people understand it. And even then, if they don't, it doesn't really matter. And you sort of hope people come along for the ride, and the world is so much more interesting now. And you can connect with people in a way that you couldn't. And so, like, if I had to change, steer the ship in a different way, and I didn't have a plan to reinvent myself. Like, it's, that sounds like literally like Madonna, what we talked about at the start. But I just wanted to do the things I wanted to do. And that was, but it's been much easier with Instagram. So that's been able to sort of change everything, as it has for a million people. And we can, it's not, it's, it, you connect with people and you meet new people. Probably not as exciting as it used to be, but it's still a great way to find out what other people do. And, you know, I've been really lucky with that stuff. But I like the idea that you can, there's enough people out there. You know, you don't need all of them.
And do you have a bit of a mission, like, to reach, like, I feel like what you're doing is kind of niche compared to, say, commercial radio. And so you've got this very engaged but smaller audience than, I guess, what you have had back in the day when you were doing radio. Do you feel like you're on a mission to ever, like, you want to save a building or you want to get people excited about stuff so that houses don't get knocked down? Like, do you feel a sense of obligation or mission to kind of get people pumped about design, or is that just a nice kind of outcome that you didn't intend?
Yeah, I think so. Say, obviously, Streets of Your Town had a very specific purpose in terms of, if we understand that we're great at something, we can understand we can be great at it again. And that was very much when I did the Design Nation exhibition and the talk with that, which I sort of was desperately, and I think it will become a TV show at one stage, which is looking at industrial design and saying, okay, well, we used to really value our own things and they say a lot about us. Why don't we do that now? It's more than globalization. Like, why don't we value that? I don't know. So if we elevate what we do, because I think what we create, what we design defines us far more than anything else. It's so much more important to us than what we do on the sporting field. Like, it has such a long-term effect on us. Because, you know, like, sporting achievements, there's a consistency to them. You either always win or always lose. But specifically, things that we do well, we should celebrate a lot more. And we've forgotten that, I think. I think it's coming around again.
Yeah.
I think I'm waiting for it to, and it will pop mainstream. I firmly believe that. The best way to do that, I suppose, for what I do is the TV shows. And I think someone said to me the other day, it was someone I worked with and hadn't seen for years and very conservative and really liked the show, hadn't really thought about it. And the idea that you can maybe do some history and some learn this, learn that, entertainment, hit a design, not devaluing it, but like, take you on a journey that's sort of interesting. And, you know, I've got some good people who help that things happen. So that's the most mainstream thing. I think it's harder, you know, with the battle for Sirius is a really interesting point, because if you connect people with a sense of place in terms of memory, you know, try to say, oh, why do I like this building? Why is this really, what is it that's, and it, a lot of the time, in terms of history around here, it's like, oh, I was on a tram, I went past when I was a kid with dad. So how can we value a football stadium because it's part of who we are? Or how can we value something else that's just as important? And so with the Sirius building, the Brutalist building we're still trying to save in Sydney, I struggled a lot with trying to work out why people didn't like it. And I think that's the hardest one. And I spend more time trying to, rather than fighting everyone going, oh, you're an idiot because you don't like this. Work out why. And the discussion for me becomes very much like, you know, one of the biggest issues we have with our brothers and sisters is when they don't see the things the same way as us. And so how can someone, and this is a new thing that I've been talking about, is most of the people who want to knock these things down are my age. They're white men, 45 plus, and they enjoy it for whatever reason. But that we all grew up, those people, we grew up in the same Australia. We saw the same things, but we see them in different ways. And so our frustration with our brothers and sisters is like, how do we grow up in the same house, but you don't see this? Why don't you And so trying to understand why they don't, why can't you not have an emotional connection to architecture? And so how do you make them connect in a different way? So with Sirius, it was about how can you – well, you might not like it. Architecture's not pizza. Not everyone's supposed to like it. But how can you can't argue with history.
Yeah.
So you might say this is ugly. I don't like Sirius, but it's part of history.
Yeah.
And so that's trying to find other ways for people to engage with it and say, well, oh, yeah, you're right. Yeah. Okay. And then the more you talk about it, you see a softening. And I think one of the big victories we had with Sirius in terms of was one particular politician who started off by saying, it's as ugly as a car park, you know. And because so many people had put photos up when they do the Vivid, where they project all the things, we hijacked it and put hides and projectors and projected against it. So everyone thought it was part of Vivid. And by the end of it, he was actually saying, well, it's some angles, it looks okay.
Yeah.
And so you reposition where the conversation is, or it's everything's about trying to let people have a look at things with fresh eyes. And so it's not the next battle is the 15-year-old buildings or the 20-year-old buildings that people are going, oh, let's, oh, it's a bit tired. You know, oh, it's a bit ugly. I don't get it. Like, I don't get that. That's what scares the shit out of me. Like, oh, it's like, oh, you know, it's old, it's tired, it's out of date, it's ugly, it needs to be refreshed. And that's a really, why do we do it? And it's a particularly Australian thing, I think.
Well, it's, I was going to ask you about that thing of ugliness, or I guess buildings that aren't beautiful in the way that Sirius isn't traditionally beautiful, and why they're still important, or why, you know, I guess what attracts us, what attracts you to a building like that, even if it doesn't have the hallmarks of a traditionally beautiful kind of building?
Sometimes it's just because it works. So, like, if you go up the road here and we've got a wonderful fight going on at the moment, and it's a really interesting fight about the Apple building, what you can't argue with Fed Square is it works. It works its tits off in terms of a meeting space and a place for people to be. Whether or not those particular buildings don't work, I don't know. But you lose the one thing is it suddenly is after, I don't know, how old is it?
What?
Fed Square.
Oh, God, I don't know. No, it doesn't, I have no idea. Yeah.
But, you know, it starts being part of people's memories. So, you know, we've got a new generation of people who's, oh, you know, I was there one day and someone gave me a free something or other. And that's your memory. Oh, I was with Dad walking past it and they're giving away. I remember just where, you know, as a kid, like going to see the Birdman rally or something, and, you know, we were walking past where it is now, where the old SEC buildings were, and, you know, they're giving away corn chips. We'd never seen corn chips before, believe it or not. And then it's like, oh, we've got corn chips, tastes like cardboard. That's how we saw them at the time. But that's where your memories are made. And so there's a new generation of people who have said, oh, you know, this has been where I've met my friends as a teenager and now they're adults since it's been there for long enough. I think that the cohesiveness of it's really important. It's a battle you guys have to have on it. But what makes it great is that it's worked.
Yeah.
And whether you like it or not, I don't know. I like that it works.
Yeah.
That's my attraction to it.
Yeah.
I think I've seen people meet here. I've seen people fall over the place and hang out and be there. They don't feel uncomfortable. It's everything that a civic square should be. And there's not many of them work anymore. Most people don't really want to hang out and meet anywhere. Most cities in the world, they're sort of like gone. Mm. But here it's very much, it works. In Sydney, there's no real, they've got little places, but people don't meet anywhere. So, yeah, I think that's a classic example and it's a really interesting fight going on. But how do you get the general public really involved in that? Really hard because people like iPhones.
Yeah. Well, I think in that case, it's also a battle between a kind of civic space and you know, a kind of corporate or shopping centre kind of space and, you know, not wanting to protect the civic space as opposed to – even though there are retail tenancies and stuff.
Yeah. I think it's – the thing that I find really curious is that there's certain people, including the original architect, who is quite happy for it to change. But, like, everyone's got a really different view on their back catalogue, you know. It's like – you're Donald Bates, you go, you know what, I've been living it for years. I don't care anymore. I don't know.
Yeah.
I thought it was a really interesting – his argument's really interesting in terms of things evolving. And I think things do need to evolve. We can't protect everything. But I think that's a fight worth fighting.
Yeah. I'm going to ask you one more question, then we're going to open up to see if anyone else wants to ask you a few questions. In that case, what is probably a big question, what do you think makes a building iconic or worth that fight? Because not – I mean – not every building must be able to be saved or worth fighting for. So what, in your opinion, are the hallmarks of a building that should warrant that treatment of being kind of saved from?
I sort of think they all should be saved, but I think, hey, it depends what they are. Like, if they have an unsexy use, it's really tricky.
Like serious?
Yeah.
Like
public housing? Public housing's pretty unsexy, isn't it? But, yeah, I think if everyone's used them in some way, I think if they are truly unique in terms of that's the only one, that's what Sirius is. It's the only one of those.
Yeah.
Will you survive if you lose that building to the Apple store? Yeah, you will survive. But if they wanted to raise the whole thing, everyone should be fighting in the street for it. Because the point is, you don't save them for today. You save them for 50 years to 100 years because they're part of our history in that way. And I think it's always an individual thing because the things that I like, not always everyone else understands. I'm more drawn to, I suppose, now the buildings that aren't easily classified as beautiful, yeah. The ugly ducklings, because you got to put your forward-thinking glasses on and think, oh, how would someone look at that? Because the saddest thing is, you know, if you Google the destroyed buildings of Melbourne, you will cry when you look at those things. Like, oh, my God, you think. And the dirty secret of modernism is that some great stuff was destroyed for the buildings that I love, big sections of it. So that goes with it. But I think they've got to be, you know, a good or a great architect. They've got to be unique in terms of really, truly. But I actually think huge sections of our suburbs should be heritage listed. So I my view on this has changed dramatically in the last 2 years because the developments happen so quickly. Any of our existing inner city suburbs, like, we should treat Richmond the same as we should Beaumaris in terms of, you know, terrace houses have been protected, but anything sort of 20th century should be just protected. We need to, like, quarantine those areas, because if we don't, we'll turn around and we'll go, oh, my God, what were we thinking? Because we haven't learned from the past by any stretch of the imagination. The greed is, like, through the Richter scale. And if you are going to pull down something, and that happens, just make sure we replace it with something that's better, that's going to inspire people in some other way.
Yeah, easier said than done. Does anyone have any questions or would like to have a little chat with Tim?
Oh, sorry. I live in Beaumaris and I see a lot of single-story glass-fronted buildings destroyed within 3 or 4 weeks, and then Neo-Georgian stuff goes up. Just welcome your thoughts on that.
I mean, exactly. You're talking about the suburb that I think should be quarantined completely, and I got an email from someone who saw me do the heritage address a couple of weeks ago and took great offence to my view that the whole suburb should be quarantined. And they said, well, you know, what about people's superannuation? No, you're ruining their lives by heritage listing buildings. And it's like everyone's lived with heritage for a long time. And how you get around it, what do we do? Like, what we don't do is enough incentives. Like, if you have a heritage listed building, guess what? You only pay half the council rates. That's what they do in New Zealand. There's plenty of places where they do it. Or you get a tax deduction for restoring them or something like that, you know. There's all sorts of different ways we can do it. But, like, why I think this is always important is park the architecture for a second. What the houses by Morris a lot of the time represent, and many other suburbs like that, is that's the last generation where our parents or grandparents built the houses themselves. So that's the history. We outsource everything today, but they are the houses where mums and dads picked up the nail bag and they built our own homes. And you can't argue with the history of that. And so that is like knocking over the terrace houses. That's like knocking over, you know, any of the other, you know, beautiful buildings that we deem to be more important. So the hardest things with those houses, I always say, is that we all know how to look after a California bungalow, how to extend it. You know, you keep the front, and then, oh, we'll do what bloody Jeremy and Tracy did. They just put this big thing at the back, you know, open plan living. And we all know how to do that. But modernist buildings are ubiquitous in that way. And so they're all different, and so there's not a standard design to them. So every one of them is a different challenge, and so there's no one standard way to make them work for the future. So terrace houses have been pretty easy. And I think terrace houses are really interesting because I always call them they're like the cockroach of design. They just keep powering on because we accept them in every single guise. And if you think of the ways that you've interacted with a terrace house, a student house, dentist, lawyer, brothel. Laughing a bit too hard there, sir. And you never question their use. You never say, I'm in an Italian restaurant that used to be someone's house. Never. It doesn't even come into your mind. So why can't we think about that as the great modernist houses or the great modernist buildings? We just, you know, they are brilliant at that. And that, as a lot of that's come out of those great people. Everything happens for a reason. That comes from, and a lot of them were the great architects of the 1950s and 60s and 70s who got on board to protect Carlton, Fitzroy, Richmond, South Yarra, the whole lot. And they believed very much in looking after those terrace houses and started using them in different ways. And so, but you know, dealing with those idiots in Beaumaris who just go, oh, you know, poor old pensioners, you know, you're getting rid of their superannuation. It's like the value of their house is not going to disappear. The value of all those houses in Beaumaris are going to go up because people are buying into a really amazing suburb where, you know, you think about those mums and dads back in the day weaving their way through the tea trees with the wood on their shoulders to build this, build that. You know, we've got to look after that because that's not architecture. It's history.
Hi, I'm Lucy. I came to your Adelaide show.
With your mum. Hi, Lucy.
My mum, you remember?
Yeah,
nice to see you. Well, first off, I can't tell you how lovely that show was. I mean, I did mention it at the time, but it was such a great bonding experience for my mum and I. You know, it just transcends generations and just made her feel things about, I mean, she still talks about it now. She feels things about her childhood house that I don't think she even had considered in hindsight until coming to that show and hearing songs about Mission Brown paint and all that stuff. And so thanks again because it was amazing. But I have a sort of two-part question. First one is I know you've performed the show in different sort of versions around the world and how have you made it? Because what you did was intrinsically Australian, the stories that you were weaving. How have you actually translated that to overseas audiences? And secondly, are there any particular powerful experiences you've had in any, you know, amazing buildings that you could share with us from that show?
Yeah, I suppose we just take a lot of the Australian out of it, especially the UK where the same suburban modernism is very different in terms of houses. So, but the attraction's very similar. So one of the guys I met on the interwebs who did our Sirius posters, my mate Pete, who has this brutal house, and he did a great book, and his take on modernism and brutalism is exactly the same as mine, nostalgia-based. It's the same thing as a kid. Saw these buildings, loved them, grows up, loves them. And modernism is, it's as international as it gets. So the pull's the same in terms of nostalgia. The concerns are the same in terms of people knocking them over wherever you are. We think that there's certain places do it better than others in terms of protecting them. Not true. We're no better or no worse than Palm Springs. They're doing all sorts of awful things. So, and then the highlights from overseas. I did like there was a time I really liked. We were doing this. It's sort of strange to perform with people's houses that you sort of barely know. And I was doing a viewing of Streets of Your Town. I was doing a screening in London, and this guy came along. A little guy came along, and he said, "Oh, I've got a little apartment in Trellick Tower. I know Goldfinger, and I know you like, you know, Goldfinger because I've got this relative in Australia and they told me to come and see your TV show. You know, do you want to come and see me apartment?" And I went, okay. So we went the next day. I went to his apartment and Trellick Tower and just near Notting Hill, and beautiful, brutalist building and mixed-use building, and he's got a perfectly renovated and really interesting apartment. And I was like, this is great, tiny. I said, oh, yeah. I was like, this is great. Can we do a show for the Festival of Architecture next year? Oh, that'd be great. Love to have you here. And so we sell some tickets, and it is small. And so it's probably, I don't know, I think we sold 25 tickets or something. It's the only amount we could fit in. And for whatever reason, and it always happens with the shows, is that people book tickets and then can't get a babysitter, forget, whatever. Sometimes it's two people. This particular show, I think it was like 9 people that didn't turn up. And so you go from a 25 to someone do the math on that. And it goes from being a show to being in a sort of a bit like where my kids go, we're going to do a dance for you. And so we're doing the show, and for those of you who haven't seen it, my best friend Kit sings a few songs. I tell some stories. We sing some songs together. And there was a guy in the front row, and he's got this big mane of grey hair, massive guy. And because it's so intimate, you can see people smiling, not laughing, all that sort of stuff. And everyone's generally having a good time. But this guy, nothing, giving us nothing. He's looking around, looking at the pot plants, looking at the paintings. He's like, I was like, what's going on here? And as soon as the show was finished, it was really disconcerting in a very small crowd. As soon as the show finished, he got up and he went over to the table we had on the side, and we had books, merchandise, and he bought everything. Kids there, and he bought records, CDs, the whole lot, everything we possibly had. And I went, oh, this is – kids started talking about, I need to find out what's going on with this guy. So I went over to him, and he was there with his wife. And I said to him, oh, hi. And he goes, oh, it's good to see you again. We came to see your last show that you did at the other Erno Goldfinger. Last time we flew over all the way from Switzerland to see the show, and we liked it so much that we flew over again to see this one. You should come to Switzerland and do a show. And I was like, no fucking way. They'll be like, you go.
Wow.
Yeah. But the thing is, it has been a challenge because I'm a little bit Australian, if you haven't noticed. But
I know, when you just said before, I take the Australian out of it. I'm like,
how do I do that? There's not much of the show left.
We might have time for one more question if anyone's got one in to finish the night over there. Yep.
Tim, what's the latest status for the Sirius building? I've lost track.
Yeah. So at this stage it's for sale, and most – there are certainly a lot of people who have put in bids to buy it who are going to look after it. So one particular is a superannuation firm who want to restore it, and they'll have some key worker accommodation, and then they'll sell the other apartments. The one saving grace with the apartment block is that where it sits near the Sydney Harbour Bridge, if you knock it down, you can only build to the top level of the bridge, not high up where it is. Then again, someone might buy it and clad it with some sort of terrible product, which is could be likely. Unlikely to be knocked over, but it could be changed dramatically. So we're just waiting to see at the moment. Okay, the green ban remains on it, so it could be difficult for them to knock it over. But we'll just see. But we did our best. It's in the lap of the gods at the moment.
Please join me in thanking Tim so much.
Thank you very much.
Keep up to date with Tim's diverse creative endeavours, including the Man About the House shows across Australia, you should follow him on Instagram at Modernista. You can also keep up to date with Tim via his website at timross.com.au. Tim lives in a seriously enviable mid-century home in Sydney with his family. You can check out our photographs and a video of his beautiful home via the link in our show notes. Or if you're listening via the Enhanced podcast, you'll be seeing some pics right now. Tim also shared his daily routine with us for our Extraordinary Routines column a couple of years ago. You can revisit that story via the link in our show notes too. And finally, The Rumpus Room is Tim's self-published book full of nostalgic tales inspired by Australian architecture and suburban pastimes. We featured the book when it came out last year, and we'll include a link to that story too in our show notes. You've been listening to TDF Talks, a podcast from The Design Files, Australia's most popular design blog. This episode is supported by Mercedes Me, a cafe, event space and concept store operated by Mercedes-Benz on the corner of Collins Street and King Streets in Melbourne. Today's episode was recorded live at Mercedes Me. To keep up to date with all events taking place at the venue, you can follow them on Instagram at mercedesmestore.melbourne. If you're Melbourne-based, we are hosting a new series of Meet the Makers events over the next 6 months at Mercedes Me, featuring some of our favourite local creatives. We've just released some additional seats for Tantri Mustika's ceramics demonstration, lettering with the Letterettes, and floristry with Hattie Malloy. Tickets are free, but you do have to book, so please visit thedesignfiles.eventbrite.com to secure your spot. As always, all the links mentioned today can be found in our show notes at thedesignfiles.net/podcast. And of course, you can also visit our main website, thedesignfiles.net, where we post new stories 3 times a day featuring Australian design, art, architecture, and more. Thank you so much for tuning in, and if you've enjoyed today's episode, please subscribe to TDF Talks on iTunes. Thanks for listening.